Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. What doesn't count is a waiver of sovereign immunity edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 20th, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Sossamon versus Texas. The question in this case was the following: when states accept federal funds, does that constitute consent on the part of the states to waive their sovereign immunity to suits for money damages under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000, or RLUIPA? In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held by a vote of 6-2 that when states accept federal funding, they do not consent to waive their sovereign immunity to private suits for money damages under RLUIPA. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Alito joined the opinion of Justice Thomas. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Breyer joined. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Jacob R. Loschen, who is an associate at Winston & Strawn, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Loschen.
The Supreme Court recently decided the case of Sossamon versus Texas. In a 6-2 decision authored by Justice Thomas, the court held that monetary damage remedies are not available to prisoners who sue under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. First, a little background. The Act, which is known as RLUIPA for short, was passed by Congress in the year 2000. It was designed to carve out accommodations for religious exercise in two areas where Congress found religious exercise to be particularly threatened. One was land use regulation, and the other was prisons and other institutions where people are involuntarily committed. In the prison context, Congress observed that failures to accommodate religious exercise were particularly worrisome because prisons are highly regimented environments where the government controls a prisoner's every action at every moment of the day. So RLUIPA gave prisoners a right to reasonable religious accommodations. It provided that no government shall impose a substantial burden on a prisoner's religious exercise unless the burden is the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling government interest. But what remedies would prisoners have to enforce that right? Here, RLUIPA was less clear than it arguably should have been. Although RLUIPA indisputably created a cause of action for prisoners to sue state prison officials, it did not specify the particular kind of relief that would be available. Instead, it indicated that prisoners could sue for, quote, appropriate relief. And that left open a question about whether appropriate relief includes compensatory damages. This brings us to Harvey Leroy Sossamon III. He's an inmate at a Texas prison who sued Texas under RLUIPA for denying him opportunities to engage in Christian worship services. He was one of several inmates in disciplinary confinement who was not permitted to leave his cell to attend religious services, even though inmates were allowed to leave their cells to do other things, like attend educational classes and use the library. Sossamon and his co-religionists were also barred from using the prison chapel for religious services, even though inmates were allowed to use the chapel for various non-religious purposes, like marriage training sessions, sex education, and parties for GED graduates. So Sossamon sued the state of Texas, requesting both injunctive and monetary relief. And the issue for the Supreme Court was whether he could get monetary damages. That depends on whether damages were authorized by RLUIPA's allowance of, quote, appropriate relief. And in its recent decision, the Supreme Court decided that appropriate relief does not include damages. But what the heck does appropriate relief really mean? As Justice Thomas noted, this phrase is open-ended and ambiguous about what types of relief it includes. So if there's a theme running through both the majority and the dissent's analysis of the statutory language, it's that context is key. As Justice Thomas put it, what relief is appropriate is inherently context-dependent. And a number of different contexts were at play here. The first important context is the fact that RLUIPA authorizes lawsuits against state governments, which implicates the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Under the doctrine, a state cannot be sued unless it consents to be sued, by expressly waiving its sovereign immunity. The majority put great emphasis on this principle and strongly reaffirmed the rule that ambiguous statutes will be construed in favor of the sovereign. The majority thought that a reference to appropriate relief was not the kind of unambiguous statement required to waive sovereign immunity for damages. This is all the more so in light of the second context in this case, federalism, RLUIPA is a federal statute that authorizes lawsuits against state governments. So this is not merely a matter of a state directly waiving its own immunity. And there's no enumerated power in the Constitution that gives Congress the ability to regulate state prisons. So Congress gets around these problems by making a deal with the states. Congress conditions its regulations on the receipt of federal funds, which it has the power to dispense under the spending clause. If a state chooses to accept federal funds, it must accept the strings Congress attaches to it. In this spending clause context, the Supreme Court has often used the analogy of a contract between the federal government and the states. And as a consequence, the court has required that Congress make clear to states exactly what they're in for when they accept federal funds. Like any contract, they must knowingly accept the terms of the deal. Using this contract analogy for context, Sossamon argued in this case that appropriate relief had to include damages because damages are always available and indeed are the preferred remedy for a breach of contract. But the majority added yet more context to Sossamon's analogy, pointing out that contracts with the sovereign are unique. Although damages may be the ordinary remedy for breach of contracts with a private party, they're not the ordinary remedy for breach of contract with the sovereign. A third context was relevant here as well, and that was two of the court's prior decisions, Franklin and Barnes, which implied rights of action in federal civil rights statutes and assumed that all appropriate remedies were available, which the court in those cases understood to include damages. Sossamon argued that the context of those prior interpretations made it clear that appropriate relief included damages here too. But those cases did not involve suits against entities subject to sovereign immunity. They were against municipalities who were not subject to sovereign immunity. So the majority reasoned that, quote, congressional silence had an entirely different implication there than it does here. Although a damage remedy might ordinarily be implied, it cannot be implied against a sovereign. In a dissent authored by Justice Sotomayor and joined by Justice Breyer, however, those justices understood RLUIPA's language in a different context than the majority. The dissenters stressed that the relevant context was not so much sovereign immunity, but instead, quote, general remedies principles. And under these general and longstanding principles, the usual remedy for a violation of a legal right is damages. As the dissenters put it, damages are the default, and equitable relief is the exception. Although the dissenters acknowledge the sovereign immunity and federalism contexts of this case, they considered it obvious that the state had consented to suit because it would have understood RLUIPA's language in light of ordinary remedies principles. In other words, we shouldn't presume that Congress or the states read RLUIPA with their heads in the sand. They were considering the context of the statute's language, too. Thus, the dissent accused the majority of discovering ambiguity where none is to be found. The dissent also raised a question to which the majority had no real answer. Nobody disputes that the phrase appropriate relief waives sovereign immunity for injunctive relief. So why should we assume that the term is too ambiguous to waive immunity for damages, but not too ambiguous to waive immunity for injunctive relief? This is an interpretive paradox. If the phrase is truly ambiguous, as the majority believes, then it is ambiguous as to both remedies. Yet that would be absurd. As the dissenters put it, it would be a particularly curious reading of the statute to conclude that Congress's express provision of a private right of action to seek appropriate relief against a state nonetheless left plaintiffs suing for state violations of RLUIPA with no available relief. And so, faced with the fact that appropriate relief must mean something, the dissenters reasoned, based on ordinary remedies principles, that damages remedies are included by default. There is one final context in this case that bears mention, and that is the practical context of what the Supreme Court's decision will mean for RLUIPA litigation. The dissenters express concern that, as they put it, plaintiffs suing state defendants under RLUIPA will now be forced to seek enforcement of their rights with one hand tied behind their backs. That's because equitable remedies are often no real remedy at all for RLUIPA violations. without damages, there's no remedy for serious non-recurring violations, nor for situations where the transfer of a prisoner or a change in policy moots the need for an injunction. So this decision is likely to take some of the teeth out of RLUIPA. It is also likely, at least for one justice, to induce some headaches. Justice Sotomayor worried that in order to secure a waiver of immunity under the majority's new rule, Congress must now itemize in the statutory text every type of relief meant to be available against sovereign defendants. I, for one, she said, do not relish the prospect of federal courts being presented with endless state challenges to all manner of federal statutes on the ground that Congress failed to predict that a laundry list of terms must be included to waive sovereign immunity for all forms of relief. Time will tell whether that worry comes to pass.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.